podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Oh, it's a goal. Who got the assist? Who got the assist?
I think I'll open a beer pretty early on in this one. I'm not going to lie. I think after doing my game review, I'm just going to mute myself, open a beer, and then when we get into the actual main bit, maybe a bit slurred, and I apologise for that, and I'll edit it down to make it sound like I know what I'm talking about. Hello, so the first week back after an international break is a real banger for some, whilst for others it's a case of cursing retaking penalties, and in my case, my Twitter memeing performance far exceeding the sorry state of my wildcard. Yes, FPL is back, and we're back too, reunited as a trio actually for the start of a deluge of football from this week onwards. The international break was the last break until game week 17, so January 2021. Let's get into this then. Nick, you alright? What's going on?
Hey Tom, yeah, I'm all right, thanks. I've been pretty busy, pretty swamped with work, unfortunately outside the FPL world, so it's all been a bit manic, but got a week off next week, certainly looking forward to that, and yeah, happy because it's been a good week for me, FPL-wise. So yeah, we are Who Got The Assist. If you want to join our league, the league code is CPSULF, and make sure to follow, listen and subscribe to the podcast through the usual podcast channels. We're also, as Tom alluded to, welcoming back a long lost stranger to the pod in the shape of Anthony. How are you doing? How did your exams go?
That's good to be back. I'm almost nervous being back on the pod. It's like having not been on one in a while, you know. It's like all those things you've been used to, it is almost gone again. But yeah, it's been the guts of a month since I last joined you. Exams done, thankfully, until the spring in regards to those ones, but I have deadlines coming up for my masters, so no rest for the wicked at Stag Towers in that regard. The international break for Ireland, it was a good time to continue our century-long conversation with ourselves about our identity as seen through the sporting lens through all of our major sports, GAA, rugby and football. We flew headlong into the issue, really, with a mix of centenaries, revolutionary talk, Jack Grealish, Declan Rice, and misleading Daily Mail headlines, shock horror, about a video shown to Irish players in Wembley. I don't know if you guys caught that story at all. But yeah, our footballers, kind of continuing the trend of disappointment, finished 2020 without a win and having scored just once in the whole entire calendar year. So pretty bleak. Looking forward to next year with that. As for who got the assist, lovely to see in my absence that Tom, kind of reminiscent of Dani Alves, I think. He's reinventing himself as he enters his early 30s. But in contrast to Dani, Tom is doing it through a postmodernist and deconstructivist art in the form of memes. And Nick, good to see you've cut down the beard a bit and powering towards the top 100k as well. So good chance for a tilt at a great rank this season. As for the pod this week, what we're going to be doing is just looking at the impact of luck in FPL in the wake of people, I guess, getting pretty annoyed about the goings-on this week, vis-a-vis penalties, etc. And just in general, it being quite a hard season to predict. And this is something we've touched on so many times in the pod, but it hasn't been the focal point. Correspondence this week, back with me again, reading the correspondence. We're going to be looking at stacking assets from individual clubs. And then we're going to have our regular Q&A. First of all, though, the game week reviews.
Oh, I'm going to go first and get out of the way, pull the plaster off. I'm not very happy. As you maybe you won't be able to tell because I'm putting a brave face on it as per the Steve Carroll gif. But I got 48 on my wild card, which is absolutely unacceptable to use a Mikel Arteta-ism. I guess we'll talk about luck in a little bit. But none of it went my way this week. So I sold McCarthy and I put in the top Martinez in goal, who got the one-pointer, which is absolutely fantastic. At the back, I had Chilwell with a clean sheet. I doubled up with Cancelo and Diaz. I knew that wasn't going to work out very well this week, so I took the L on that. Kilman only got a two tonight. In the midfield, Sadio Mane, threw on goal a couple of times against Leicester. At least had a very good chance against Leicester, couldn't do anything. Fernandes scored a penalty, of course. Grealish, nothing. Ziyech, nothing. And up front, Watkins had a penalty overturned, I suppose. Vardy was my captain and two big misses in that game, as well as him missing his one big chance. Very annoying. And Calvert-Lewin, who was my vice-captain, got 13. So overall, 48 points, down to 2 million. So 500k ranked loss from your wildcard. Exactly what you want when you do wildcard. Because, guys, the key is, I'm lulling you all into a false sense of security. Now I've got lowest of a low. Every other game we've got this can be a green arrow. So I'm setting myself up for happiness. The sunlit uplands of the future are in front of me. And I'm looking forward to delving into that great, beautiful tomorrow. But Yeah, I don't know. I do regret nothing, all right, except my fervour and maybe captaining Vardy, because there's no world in which I wouldn't have wildcarded 2 weeks ago. So I can't be like, oh, yeah, well, you know, I wish I hadn't and blah, 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 because that was never a possibility. Who came second? I'm pretty sure it was Anthony, because Nick was very, very happy.
Yeah, it's me. Honestly, I kind of feel like I've been away a month and almost nothing has changed in that, you know, I'm still kind of middling along around 1 point something million. Nick is just flying along and Tom's just a wee bit behind me. So 59 points for me this week. Martinez in goal. I brought in Cancelo. No good. 1 point. Mitchell didn't play. Dallas off the bench. So that's nice to get his points for once. Kufal and Chilwell with the clean sheets. A midfield of disappointment in spite of all of them really having good opportunities between Mane, Grealish, De Bruyne and Suchek. And then up top, thankfully, and I avoided catastrophe by captaining Dominic Calvert-Lewin. And I also have Harry Kane there with a four-pointer. So that's 59 points in total. Look, I'm just finding it very hard to break the ceiling of 1 million so far this season. I feel like if I get my captaincy right, I've missed some of the big hitters. In midfield, you know, for example, it would be Bruno Fernandes or Son, who I just never have had this season, continually missing out on 10-pointers, 11-pointers. And then even if I get the captaincy right, it's still just a game week points that probably matches about the top 10K and doesn't get you anywhere.
I know the feeling very well.
Yeah, like this week, in fairness, would have been a horror week a few weeks ago when I had absolutely no form whatsoever. I wouldn't have captained Calvert-Lewin and this would have been a 40-something point week. And at least I avoided that fate. But at the same time, this is the point in the season where we really need to be starting to make gains, like old Nicholas is, as he's about to go into in a second. And Tom and I, neither of us are. Now, Tom at least has set up with a wild card. I'm not sure where I'm going, really. I brought in Grealish and Cancelo this week. I kind of fancied City against Spurs, as daft as that might sound. So I actually brought him in for Semedo. And of course, the Semedo bit worked out, but the Cancelo bit didn't. And Grealish, look, it was really a choice. It was Salah out, and I brought in Grealish instead of Bruno Fernandes. It was kind of more of a long-term transfer in doing that. But of course, you could say that, you know, a Grealish might be for Christmas, but Bruno Fernandes is for life, you know? Like, the man is just getting points all the time, and maybe I just need to just recognise that and keep him in my team.
Yep, he came into my team this week and, got 78 points all in all, so pretty happy with that.
Get off the stage.
Overall rank 150k, starting to reach sort of respectability. Just need to try and maintain it if I can.
Reach respectability. Tom, where are we?
Non-respectability.
A bit of dirt on the bottom of his shoe.
Yeah, it's like, geez, I'm just going to be Nick on this podcast soon, guys. We'll see you later.
Yeah. Just a supporting cast, Kenny Rowland and the
input. as I said, it's pretty good. Started pretty well with Zuma clean sheet, but then the Brighton Villa game was actually considering my score this week, was an unmitigated disaster. I had three players in that game. I got 1 point for Grealish, one for Martinez, and a minus one for Lamptey. So just 1 point net from three players in that particular game. However, as I said, things went pretty well after that. Bruno got a nice 22-point return, much to the chagrin of the non-owners, but we'll probably cover that a little bit later on the pod. I still had the dynamic duo of Son and Kane in my team, so 14 points from those guys. And Sunday was pretty brilliant, really, with 13 points from Calvert-Lewin and a 12-pointer from Robertson. So that went really well. Monday started badly, I guess, with Zaha being out, having to isolate, which meant that I had Walker Peters coming off the bench. For a lovely 2-pointer.
He's got a bonus point as well, Nick.
he was on for free actually before they lost that clean sheet. But so a bonus apparently for him. So another point there, and two bonus and an assist for Shea Adams as well in that game. So he got 8 points. So yeah.
Nick, you managed to generate points from absolutely nowhere. Like, it's actually phenomenal. Like, where did you get all those points, this guy? Fair play. Well played.
Pretty happy with that.
I'm not surprised. I think you were very assertive the other day. I said, I've got Vardy captain, it'll be fine. You're like, no chance. I've got Robertson, mate. I've got Robertson assist. Maybe a clean sheet will be fine, yeah. Damn it, I hate you when you're right. Right, let's move on to the market forces. This is where we look through the movers and shakers in the economy, see what's been going on, who's buying, who's selling, what's happening. Nick, what is going on?
So it's all about Diogo Jota, actually, from Liverpool, with 229,000 transfers in. So he only actually cost 6.6 million. I was surprised how cheap he was, really. But yeah, he's got four goals to his name now, a goal in every single home game for Liverpool so far this season, and three goals in the last four. So really starting to attract the attention of managers who are looking at sort of a cut price Liverpool asset. And he also appears to be nailed on now as well, with Klopp adapting his formation a little bit to allow him to play alongside Firmino, Salah and Mane. So that's good. Yeah, definitely looks like a decent asset there. He's got twice as many transfers as any other player this game week. But otherwise, it's Bruno Fernandes, of course, off the back of that 11-point return. He's had 100,000 transfers in now for him. So he's getting plenty of returns like he did last season. The bloke just seems to pull points out of his anywhere, really. So, yeah, good week for Bruno owners, of course, and Bruno captainers. We'll talk about him in a little bit. But otherwise, Tom talks about Vardy bringing him in, obviously blanks, but hasn't stopped other people bringing him in this week, of course, because he has Fulham at home up next. Quite a decent run of fixtures for Leicester. So he's had 80,000 transfers in as well.
Yeah, quite remarkable, actually, to see that popularity for Vardy in spite of his bit of disappointment. But it just, I guess, shows you how little confidence most people have in Fulham. Amongst defenders as well, there just is one particularly popular player, and that's Ben Chilwell, who, I guess, he's a darling of the FPL community already at this point, and he's quite popular within our sphere. But I guess in the global game, everyone's kind of copping on now that Chelsea's defence is really solidified, and Chilwell himself is a really standout player within that. His value has gone up 0.6. in whatever it is, 7 weeks that he's been playing for Chelsea. So pretty incredible.
Yeah, for sure. Rounding up the top five, Calvert-Lewin still attracting owners as well. 76,000 transfers in off the back of that brace. Now the top scorer in the Premier League with 10 goals this season and one assist as well. So having a great campaign so far. Now 59% owned as well. So, you know, really, really popular pick. If you don't own him, it will hurt a lot. But in terms of transfers out, I think that's nothing majorly exciting. Lots of flagged players being sold as expected. Like I said, Lamptey got himself sent off. Zaha's now appeared. We don't know whether he's going to be back for the next game, so it's a bit of a wait and see. Salah also being heavily sold, which is a bit of a surprise. When I clicked on it earlier, it was red flagged, which is a bit misleading. He's now gone down to a yellow flag because it is expected he is going to be back for that Brighton game. So if people are selling him 97,000 transfers out, that could be quite damaging. And Trent rounding up sort of the transfers out with 133,000 transfers out. The only other player actually there who's non-flagged is Jay Rodriguez, a bit of a shining light at the beginning of the season, but he's had nothing since that 4 points in game week five. So it's been a fallow period for the 29.1% that owned him, who perhaps were patiently waiting for that Fulham game, hoping that their patience would be rewarded, but clearly not, and now getting rid fast.
Right, okay. Let's move out the kerfuffle into luck. Oh, wait a minute. There's definitely in the meta this week with Bruno Fernandes' penalty and the retake too, hooking a good deal of conversation on social media. Some, you know, particularly hilarious takes were given. And I guess it was all about kind of the outcome there. And I guess that kind of feeds into wider sort of discussions about how much of an impact luck has on FPL and how basically the intangible has an impact on our outcomes. So I suppose the first thing I was kind of thinking here is kind of think about luck versus something called variance, which we see a lot in social media. You'll see that kind of talked up a fair bit in terms of, oh, it wasn't luck, it was just variance. Are they the same thing? What's the difference? Is there a difference between the two? There isn't one. They're basically the same thing. And it's more about semantics, whether you call your bad luck or your bad variance. To define as well, luck or variance, I think, is defines events conspiring to go your way. And luck, I think, as a word has really kind of acquired a bad name. Like, it's seen something that's a bit taboo because it implies you're not being skillful. You've had kind of, you know, dumb luck that's kind of impacted your outcome. A variance, in contrast, is often deployed to mean bad luck. And in terms of FPL, like, at its core, basically every week you're betting that the players that you've picked will do something every week. And clearly luck is a central component in that. You've done the analysis, you probably had a good feeling. But for the outcome to go your way, you need that little extra when things actually are live and in play. Because before things kick off, you can only envision positive outcomes normally. It's the hope that kills you in FPL. But when it's live, it's fundamentally out of your control, and there's always the element of luck in live action. When things get messy is when in FPL as well, we add an extra layer, which is the social come competitive element, because lots of people also play alongside you and against you. And that opens things up to interpretation, I think. Perceptions kind of kick in. And also there's presentation too. So consider the case of people who, I don't know, have fortunate outcomes, which are presented as skill. So I've taken a huge punt this week and it's paid off, fire emoji. And I'm shouting about it from everywhere. The fact is that those same people next week who have taken a huge hit and it's not worked out are not going to be shouting from the rooftops about it. So if they've taken a minus 8 hit and they've lost 30 points, it won't be anywhere to be found. And I think that layer, so from the essential game to the social side of it, is where the influence of luck is really felt the most, because that holds up the mirror to FPL managers in terms of the impact their decisions on their outcomes, especially if others are able to see those outcomes and kind of have their perceptions of it. That's kind of my opening gambit, that luck and variance are the same thing, and that luck is basically played out on the social stage more than anything else. And I'm talking about luck in a game week here rather than luck over the long term, which we'll speak about in a bit. What do you guys think about that? But luck is basically something which is reflected in the eyes of others rather than something that you have yourself.
I guess my interpretation of the difference between luck and variance, I feel like, you know, luck, it feels more of a subjective thing. You know, as you said, you see constantly people, if they do badly, they'll be bemoaning their bad luck. But if, you know, they talk about their skill, I guess, and they're distinctly quiet when it comes to sort of praising the moments of good luck instead. It's all, you know, what they did, it's based on their skill. And that's the subjective element. And I think with variance, for me, it kind of has a bit more of a statistical background. I mean, that's at least my interpretation, might not be, you know, correct facts, but variance feels like a fancy way of trying to quantify that luck. You know, for instance, in poker, it can be used to good effect. You know, you talk about sort of a pocket aces, perhaps win it being a winning hand 95% of the time. So you can quantify that variance to a certain extent. If you had the pocket aces and you lost, you know, you suffered that 5% variance, and that's more statistical. And I guess with FPL, everything does feel a little bit more subjective in terms of what happens with your game. For instance, there's no hard and fast rules we can really model. As much as we like to try and look at expected goals and various other statistics, we can't predict 100% what is going to happen. For instance, we can't say, oh, Bruno against West Brom, 9 times out of 10 means a return. It's just impossible to quantify, isn't it? And even with like the models that people put out there, that have some very good, say, you know, estimated 6.78 points from this particular fixture, but there's certain elements to reality that just can't be determined. So, for instance, did Bruno have his regular bowl of Cheerios in the morning, which would just get him through the day, or did he forget to pick them up as part of his Tesco shop? You know, were half the West Brom team struck down with COVID the day before, significantly weakening the chances? did David Coote forget to put his contacts in and then just not tell anyone, hoping he could get through the game without anyone noticing? These are all kind of real luck elements. When you talk about the variance, you can talk about the expected goals, etc. But, you know, that extra element, I think, comes down to what I would call luck, at least.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you're right in this, in some ways, and maybe you agree with me then too, that because you can't quantify it, like you said with poker, if you're pocket ace, you've got a very high chance based on a kind of a body of evidence that this is what's going to happen. You've got at least kind of a hard and fast fact that this is the touchstone versus the outcome. So you can say, well, that was X percent likely compared to a kind of a possible outcome based on a body of evidence. Here, we don't really have that in FPL, as you said, but it's a very dynamic game, and you've got all of the facts that you listed there, you know, from whether a player is able to finish properly all the way down to a referee having a bad day, as you inferred, that can have an impact on things. And I think that, as I said, a lot of the time it is about that kind of social stage, because you're comparing your results to other people, and often you have to be able to formulate a way to explain why your outcome is different to somebody else, especially if it happens consistently. You can say, you know, it's all bad luck, or it's all variance, in the same way as you said, Nick. It's all good luck, you know, it's been my skill which has meant that I was in a position to get lucky, I guess. Anthony, what do you think about this?
Well, like, I think, first of all, I would say that luck is probably just an emotional term for variance, or that people apply to variance, and kind of they do that to suit their own motives, their own message. So there is that social aspect, which kind of maybe just digs down to the basics of just why people actually play FPL, and that's obviously to do with satisfying a competitive streak, or I think more to the point, especially in the FPL community, it's proving something to themselves or to their friends or to the community, such as their expertise, their skill, their superior knowledge, their crystal ball gazing skills, etc. That means that people do kind of get much more tied up in what is in truth luck and what is, as you say, the same as variance to any degree, because like you've both gone through it there. Like the game is a game of chance. Football is a game of chance. Celtic can beat Barcelona 2-1 in that Tony Watt game. These things can happen no matter what you want to do. And so it is kind of silly to get too tied up in this luck versus variance thing. But at the same time, with FPL, there are some managers who year on year on year deliver the top results. Over the course of a 38 game week season, they manage to get extremely high ranks. Is that because they can read statistics better? Is that because they're better at watching the game? Is it just because they're better FPL managers and that's something that's totally detached from both of the last two things? Possibly, genuinely, possibly. Or maybe it might just be that they've just had an extended period of luck. It's entirely possible as well to just that some people are on just this multi-year hot streak and maybe they'll revert to the mean eventually if they kept playing FPL for 1,000 years. Maybe we'd all have the same results at the, you know, on average over that time. I don't think so. I think that there is genuinely an element of skill to it. But yeah, on a week-by-week basis, you can point to luck. You can point to goal line technology failing for that Sheffield United game last year. You can point to bad refereeing decisions. You can point to the Gerrard slip. Like, there are so many of these, like, completely immeasurable events that occur. That's just outside of the fact that, you know, the part of a person's boot matters in how they hit the ball. You know, does a goalkeeper stick their hand up just in time? I don't know, maybe. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. And that can sometimes be the reason why Sadio Mane doesn't score, but Diogo Jota does. And that's just unfortunate for us Mane owners. That's just the game.
Yeah, a bit of the boot touch on the ball reminds you of Lingard in the Nations League final that against Holland. Remember that? He was offside just by like a tiny part of his boot. When he was, yeah. Anyway, but no, I think what we're touching on there is the cringeworthy phrase, fine margins, a little bit as well. I mean, is that true? I suppose is a nice kind of way to move that on. In terms of those kind of fine margins, I think that's a really interesting point, Anthony, because if you watch any live sport, the difference between success and failure are often so infinitesimally small. Like, okay, all right, it's from my own point of view this weekend, but Vardy this weekend, for example, watching that game, Barnes missed the gilt edge chance. I think I was up and celebrating that I got an assist, frankly. And at the very end of the game, Albrighton as well, missing another one. So, okay, if both those go in, then I've got two assists and decent captain return for my captain. Another example, if Johnston bothered to obey the rules and didn't come off his line, then Bruno's penalty is saved. And that's a huge negative swing. And something the timbre of the FPL community's conversation is very, very different. Another example, if Trezeguet doesn't roll around dramatically, Watkins probably gets the penalty. But if my dad didn't have sex with my mom, then I wouldn't be saying this. So at the end of the day, there's always this kind of parallel universe, and every game week there's always sliding door moments, but we shouldn't and indeed can't live in what could have been. It's always very useful to kind of reevaluate your decision-making process if things haven't quite gone your way, rather than just blaming luck, I find, or, you know, dismissing it as being bad variance. Like, all right, this week, for example, with Bruno, I didn't pick him. I went with Vardy, and I knew that that was an outside bet. I knew that was a risk. I accepted the risk within the call. Like, rationally, I can see, I accept what happened. Emotionally, I'm still a bit annoyed, but I'm okay with the decision-making process because I looked at it, looked for it, and thought, well, okay, I think this is probably a nice one that would really kind of push me up. I mean, if I can't take a punt on the wild card, when can I? But maybe I should have considered the merits of Bruno and DCL more. But I think maybe dismissing Bruno as just being luck when we knew penalties as part of his repertoire, that was part of what makes him a potent threat in terms of being an FPL asset. I think dismissing that all as luck and just kind of minimising that perhaps is to be a little bit sweeping, maybe. What do you think about that?
I'm going to jump in on you just there because penalties is obviously something we've talked about an awful lot this season, and I think maybe even a state of the nation on penalties is almost important to go into whilst we have that point, because the fact of the matter is you can't dismiss them as luck. We've had 43 penalties so far this season. 35 of those have been scored, so that's 81%. In the whole of last season, we had 92 penalties. Now, pre-season forecast this year expected a rise in that with all the new VAR stuff. Let's not get into it, but they expected there to be about 106 to 115, so breaking records. But the fact of the matter is that with 23% of this season played, that's 88 games, we're now on course for 185 or 186 penalties this season. If we continue this, like, we are a quarter of the season into it now. You know, when we were looking at this data after 4 weeks, it was like, never going to happen. Come on, guys. I think we need to get real. Like, the penalty numbers are just off the charts, and we just need to continue to keep that in mind with our transfers. And we can't dismiss Bruno Fernandes's look. Manchester United historically get loads of penalties. Pre-VAR, pre-anything else, they got loads of penalties.
Yep.
They're still getting more penalties. They're even getting more and more penalties. And they get to retake penalties like every other team. If keepers go off their line, you get to retake them, which means the conversion rates are going to go up a little bit more. You can't dismiss them. You just can't. And like, and I'm speaking as a non-Bruno Fernandes owner, for what it's worth as well, just to make that painfully obvious to people that I'm, you know, just as annoyed by it as you might be. But you can't just dismiss it as, look, and it's not just fine margins either. There is an element of fine margins to which game the penalties come. But over a 38-game week season, he's probably going to get 10, 12, 15 penalties. Like, it's entirely possible. And you can't just dismiss that as, look, just for a given week.
Yeah, 100%. I think penalties are a critical element of the game. And that's why, as part of my own team, I've targeted a lot of penalty takers, the likes of Will Saha, etc., because Crystal Palace often win a lot as well. And it's a key element. And I think people saying, oh, Bruno was lucky, you know, with the penalty, etc., they're kind of not looking at what else happened in that game to a certain extent as well, because, you know, Bruno created more chances than anyone this game week with six. And, you know, Martial should have put a couple of those away as well. So, you know, he easily could have picked up assists and more returns anyway. So that's unfortunate. And I think with fine margins, I think it's fair enough. You know, I wouldn't say, oh, it's fine margins, I did badly. You know, I wouldn't call it an excuse. I think there's always an element, and you can look at your team. You can say, actually, with every single asset in your team, there's kind of a few fine margin stories you can share, for instance, you know, like, for me, I mean, Zaha not playing, he could have easily hauled against Burnley. That was a plum fixture for him. Or Lamptey getting all reckless and deciding he wanted to get sent off with a couple of quick yellow cards. I don't know what he was thinking about. But, you know, those sort of things. You know, Walker-Peters missing out on those bonus points. I mean, obviously, I had a really good week. But these are just stories that I can share just from this week as well. So I think there's always a case, perhaps if you're constantly bemoaning your bad luck, it doesn't come across very well. But, you know, we accept that this is a game of luck. It's not pure skill, is it?
Yeah, maybe while we're still discussing fine margins, I think there's just a few other kind of stats that are maybe worth getting into. One is hitting the post. Chris Wood, ironically, has hit the post 3 times, Timo Werner 3 times, and Treason Season Trossard with 4. So they're kind of the highest in terms of those players who've almost scored but didn't score. But I think what the sorts of players that we have in that trio, I think, kind of capture the panacea of luck. You've got someone like Timo Werner, takes a load of shots, gets loads of opportunities, will score a load of goals over the course of the season. Chris Wood, you know, respectable Premier League level striker who gets into double figures seemingly year on year. Great. A few hits of the post. You'd expect that over the course of a season. But then to point to Trossard, who's tip top on 4, like, you couldn't just say it's fine margins for Trossard, because you couldn't possibly expect Trossard to be...
Wasn't that all in one game as well?
Yeah, was it all in one game? I couldn't quite be certain on that. I wasn't sure. But yeah, I knew he'd hit it at least 3 times against Manchester United that time. You can't point to that as just being fine margins. Like, of course, it were fine margins on that specific day. But over the course of this season, Trossard is not the FPL pick that Timo Werner will be, that Chris Wood will be. And maybe XG brings us into that conversation even further. When you look at XG overperformers, Son, 5.5 overperformance, DCL, 3.5 overperformance, Kurt Zuma, 2.5 overperformance, James Ward-Prowse and Danny Ings then around 2.4 in overperformance. Kurt Zuma being 2.5 overperformance, that's, of course, there's like the fine margins and the luck has come into it. The fact that a defender's goals just happen to have come at this point in the season, because they get fairly random opportunities off set pieces for the most part when you're somebody like Kurt Zuma. But when it's someone like Son, you could point to his 5.5 overperformance and just say, well, he's also just an elite player, one of the few players in the league who could score 20 goals in a season, who seems to be in a system that gets the best out of him. DCL, likewise, has clearly improved and has clearly brought his finishing on another level. His one-touch finishing, especially, is finding him opportunities that he never had before. So within the statistics, you can kind of tell very different stories, but that's why you need to know the context behind what's going on as well. That it's not just about pointing to statistics or just saying, look, variance. You need to understand like the greater context of what's going on as well.
Absolutely. And I think to maybe bring what you both said together, what's really interesting is looking at kind of that data/eye test dichotomy and looking at mitigating or controlling the impact of luck. Because I don't know, I was thinking about what you were saying about all of these guys under and overperforming and all of these sorts of things. I was thinking, yeah, okay. So I'm watching games when that's happening and I'm just kind of thinking, right, okay, well, you know, variance can go my way. Something's going to happen. And actually what maybe, funnily enough, what that conjured up was actually memories of earlier on this season when I had Zambo and Greaser versus West Brom because Hammers was out. And that's a bit strange. And obviously it's an example in extremis. But that's an example of when it's purely luck that I'm hoping for. You know, there's no data in his favour, really. Like, no long-term information suggests he'd return. I've seen him play a couple of times. And he was 4.5 million and he was playing West Brom. And that's a really good example of the time when the outcome I knew was purely about getting lucky. If he'd done something, anything, above the 2 or 3 point baseline, then riding that Zamboni would have been incredibly lucky and nothing else. And if you think about it like a spectrum, right, from playing a player like that, maybe getting lucky, you know, Bissouma, getting a goal from him from, you know, 30 yards, like people got earlier on this season, all the way on the other end to a player like Salah, who, you know, it's posted from the numbers that suggests that him scoring frequently is a near certainty in terms of probability. Looking at things through that spectrum begins to kind of draw our focus, I suppose, towards this sort of how we assess luck and how we assess kind of controlling it. Like for me, it's about, maybe as Anthony was alluding to a little bit, having this sort of a process around when it comes to evaluating your team, your transfer, your captains. And it's an obvious point, but it's fundamentally always best to pair the eye test with data. Like, appreciate that some may not like data, but it's always very useful. Like, you know, the eye test is very good, but it's also subjective at times. So this weekend, for example, on our Slack, I said, oh, Tammy Abraham looks great here. I think he's a lot better at hold-up plays, making a good impact on Chelsea. And Adam Pritchard said, oh my God, no, I completely disagree. Like, you know, I definitely drew on. And no, I mean, he does wear turtlenecks. So can you trust a man who wears turtlenecks? Probably not. But anyway, it always emerges. It's Stag's actually wearing one. I just realized, oh God, get off the pod.
It's like I'm here, like hanging myself on my collar, just like, hello.
You should. But anyway, it always amazes me that two people can watch the same game of football and have completely different takes. And you see that microcosm played out weekly in the various comments you'll see during live games. In contrast, data is objective. It's a fact that these things happened. And this is relatively new in the kind of, you know, the scope of football. We never historically had this, and it used to be about what someone in authority said, and that often went. But of course, interpretations are subjective too. How you project these things will impact the future, which what FP managers are doing if they do some data analysis is more on the eyes of researcher. And it's almost like the eye test objectivizes data interpretation, bringing us back to what Stag was saying a minute ago. Because if you looked at the data and you say, okay, he's had loads of shots, but you know that those shots have all been crap. So think about a Neil Maupay or a Mitrovic sort of character, then that probably makes it a little bit different to if a player's having lots of shots and they're all good shots from good positions. Anyway, I always think luck will play its role, but overall having a nice kind of process when it comes to understanding a player that you're looking to bring in, looking to captain, is just so useful. Having the eye test and data, I think, integrated is always ideal.
It's always really, really important when you're trying to find the edge through the data. And I remember this from the sort of the first season I was starting to play FPL more seriously, but I wasn't a member of, you know, like a Fantasy Football Scout or Hub. At the time, I think Tom was using Fantasy Football Scout. He had Scott Dan, Craig Dawson in his team. I was like, who the hell are these guys? Why do you even have these guys? And they were banging in headers, getting loads of goals. And I was kind of this more casual player, I guess, at the time. Like, and Tom was, you know, massively thrashing me in terms of overall ranking those days. And, you know, utilising that to my own advantage recently with Kurzuma, or when we both had Matt Doherty a couple of seasons ago, sort of a 4.4 million man playing at Wolves. Excellent underlying stats. I mean, these are real life examples of using that data and, you know, analyzing it and then trying to get ahead of the game and getting ahead of the luck variance.
I think you really do need to add eye test to the stats that you have to contextualize them that little bit more, to understand the teams and to understand which players are likely to be relied on more in certain games. We'll just go back to the classic example earlier in the season when Southampton's Harry Carey high line meant that Harry Kane and Heung-min Son could just go absolutely wild against them. And so it's understanding just, you know, the context of the stats. Kane, Son, probably the ones who were going to score. And Southampton, high line, concede certain types of goals. You know, 1+1=2 and profit. And obviously that's a really easy to example to point out to you with hindsight. But I did something similar with DCL this week. And I was just like, well, Fulham are just liabilities. Dominic Calvert-Lewin is the one who's on pretty much the end of every single cross that Everton ever put into the box. Profit. You know, sometimes it's not that complex, but still look at the underlying stats for both of those sides, and to pick a player out, you know, you have to know what's going on there versus, let's say, Mitrovic, who was obviously playing in the same fixture against a defence who, as you pointed out, Nick, has a goalkeeper who doesn't exactly shower himself in glory every single week. And yet I wasn't going to put him into my team in a million years in spite of the fact that he had good underlying stats. And so it's working it out. And this isn't revolutionary to any of you guys who are listening, but at the same time, somebody might take something out of this.
I wish I had that sort of foresight, Stag. I really do. Okay, no, I think you're right. I think that's a really good kind of nice way of putting a button on this discussion, really, about luck and how that sort of all functions. So I ask you again, after having this discussion and really thinking about it together, how much of FPL is luck? Let's try to put tentative percentages on it. I think it is 60% luck, 40% skill. I really do, because I think that a lot of the time you'll see that people take high octane, especially if you think about all the winners in the past years who have come from absolutely no OR to winning it. I think that they've kind of perhaps just had that the season of their lives and they've gotten very, very lucky. You have players who do just kind of, you know, flatline all the way to a decent OR every single season, you know, the likes of Joe from Fantasy Football Scout, dullards, but they're going to, their trajectory is always going to be sort of very similar. Likes of Mark, likes of Late Riser, play people like that who take risks and do very, very well a lot of the time. Okay, that's the skill part, but I think overall it is luck if you do well or don't do well. And the more engaged you are, the more it is about skill, but the more you feel the social angle of how luck impacts you. So I'm going to say 60-40 for me. What do you guys reckon?
So I have gone a bit higher than that. I think, obviously, if you want to win FPL, you clearly need a huge slice of luck. As you said, though, we have seen these managers that prove that they can consistently deliver top 10K finishes. And that's just really impressive. You know, these elite managers, as you mentioned, like Mark or FPL Matthew, Late Riser or Fabio Voorhees. You know, in some cases, you can see victims of bad luck. Obviously, like Late Riser having a bit of a struggling season this year, but you know, typically he's just proved himself as, you know, an incredible FPL manager over the past few years. And obviously, you know, we've seen the likes of Magnus Carlsen, chess grandmaster, being number one for huge chunks of last season, though he did say in the articles printed in The Guardian that this was down to mostly luck. It was a completely different game to chess. This was all luck that he was number one, essentially. But he also said that he was an optimist as well as an optimist due to his love of the underlying data. So proves there is a skill element, of course, there. And I think, you know, 1 in 5 seasons might go a little bit bad for managers, but I'd say 80% for me. I think skill, 20% luck. Okay, it's just kind of number out of thin air, really, but that's kind of what I've gone for.
Yeah, Nick, I ran very similar calculations. I really crunched on the numbers all day, got my supercomputer going, and also came out with 80-20 in the end. I kind of feel, though, that the skill isn't necessarily just being able to read the data. I think a lot of the skill is just not to bloody panic sometimes. And that's part of the FPL skill in so much as anything, as just reading the stats and working out what you're actually seeing in front of you. It's getting hasty. It's just being a little bit good tactically. But I think what you've both stumbled upon is there is a certain truth to the fact that if you want to win FPL, I think you need much more luck than just to, as Tom put it, just flatline into a top 100K or top 10K finish every single season. There's, you know, there's a very different degree of luck in getting that over that final hurdle than there is to just, you know, largely pick popular players. Get your captaincy picks right week in, week out will make a huge deal of the difference to getting you to that top 10K rank. And like, that's where the look can really more pronounced, have a more pronounced effect on your rank. But 80-20, I'll just go with.
See. So basically, if we add it all together, what happens is that we're saying 60 versus 2/3 skill, 1/3 luck. So yeah, interesting. Probably is about right, to be honest, if you think about it. Maybe I overvalue luck to some extent because I'm thinking about winning rather than just doing well in general. But yeah, hope you can take out something from that. Hopefully it helps you think about luck in FPL and how it has an impact. And we'll have a break here and think about the correspondence and Q&A after this.
Who got the assist? Who got the assist?
So we're back and it's time to catch up with the Who Got the Assist mini league. If you want to join a league, the code is CPSUOF. We'll do a quick rundown of the top five. So in fifth, it's Wallace Clark with the ace team. 68 points for him, pretty decent week. Captained Bruno Fernandes. But in fourth, it's Graham Sessoms with HK10 for Golden Boot. Only one in the top five not to captain Fernandes, actually, but he went for Calvert-Lewin, so still a pretty decent week there, but 57 points for him. Zaki Team 2 is in third, 72 points. In second, it was David Izzet with Hest Wham Untied, 87 points for him. That's a really, really good score for the game week, but it's not enough to get him into first place because he's two behind Borisav Joksimovic with his team, and he got 80 points. So well done, Borisav. Great week for him there. 80 points. Just Bruno Fernandes, the captain, doing the business there. Likes of Calvert-Lewin, of course, and Son and Robertson, McCarthy and goal. Some of, you know, the key characters sort of doing the business there. And overall rank 375 as well, which is pretty damn decent.
Oh, yeah.
So shall we move on to correspondence then? Anthony, your favourite section, do you want to introduce?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. So like back in that 3-day pre-season that we had, or whatever it was, 10 days, it was very short. Like a mother hen, I think, I put this idea into the WhatsApp group and doubts were expressed. There was a voice memo that tried to explain it, and still... One hater, he's down there, he's in a blue top. He said that this would be dead by game week 8. Guess where we are now? Game week 9, Tom. And it's back. Correspondence section is still here, baby. And it's Oliver Smelt, who's written in from Toronto, Ontario, with his email on stacking players and teams. The correspondence section is, of course, your chance to give your input on previous pods, to express your ideas about FPL, to comment on what's going on. Basically, it's a just write in an email to whogottheassist@gmail.com and we'll probably include it in the pod at some point into the future. So Oliver emailed in quite a bit ago at this stage where we didn't quite get around to getting it in, but here we are. He started off, "Hello, Tom, Nick and Anthony. First of all, thank you for doing what you do. From Tom's unrivaled narratives and top punnery," I'm not sure if this was a Tom alt account, by the way, "to Nick's dulcet tones of level-headed calm and cool, and Anthony's clever retorts and infectious chuckles," now it's fictional, "you provide me with podcasting highlights of my week. Also, I'll be forever grateful for the Sunderland Till I Die episodes, keeping me company during the hellish grocery store trips in the initial heights of COVID." Go listen to those guys, by the way. They're pretty good. They also helped me in the sound decision not to have Jason Steele as my backup keeper in FPL this year. Anyways, in pondering the chemistry between you guys and the fact that Kane has assisted almost all of Son's goals, I wonder if there are other symbiotic pairs in FPL that are much more than the sum of their parts when paired together from an FPL perspective. I think of Anthony earlier in the season benefiting from Salah Mane's double up, how that same strategy worked for Magnus Carlsen last year, and the many other examples of these super pairs, including Kane, the Kane-Son double up, which is the gift that keeps on giving for owners this season. I know that this concept has been discussed time and time again, but given the odd nature of this season and freak results appearing more common, is it more beneficial to ensure that you'll definitely get the points from a given team by having 2 to 3 of their main attacking or defensive assets rather than diversifying your team to have good representation from different teams, i.e. Salah Mane, Sterling, De Bruyne, Foden, DCL, James, and Richarlison, Robbo, TAA, Martinez, Konsa, etc., 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 as opposed to mixing up all of those assets? Ollie has also pointed to a lot of other particular points about this strategy, that it's high risk and high reward. It allows you to get further points from a popular asset by likely getting the other half of an attacking return or or another clean sheet on top of the one you would have got from that player. He also suggests this is a family-friendly approach to FPL in that it gets you brownie points with your loved ones because you don't have to watch as many games each weekend. It's an interesting perspective on it too. Much love from the crazy canuck across the sea, Oliver.
Oh, hello, Oliver. As you know, as I said to you in the response to this email, I know a lot about T-Dot, having had an ex-girlfriend who was from there. Spent a long time in T-Dot, a very, very nice place. Yeah, great question. It's really, really interesting, actually, to think about this from an FPL perspective. And we've thought about this a lot, actually, on this very podcast. We've introduced the idea in the past of compound differentials. So looking at it through an FPL lens rather than the football lens. The idea being, I suppose, as Oliver kind of infers, that if you have a mix of players on their own, they're very well owned, but together as a combination, they give you a lot of points. This makes sense if you break it down logically. So for this year, for example, if it's an individual, it's likely you and other engaged managers will have this highly owned player. So say Dominic Calvert-Lewin this year, he's currently 58.8% owned where he was at the time I wrote these notes. So most people are going to say, do you have Calvert-Lewin? I do as well. Okay, yeah, we've got him. Add another. DCL and Son. Son's the second highest owned player at the time I wrote his notes. 57.3% say. Most people are going to say, yep, I own him. But perhaps there's a few less people who say yes than own DCL alone. So LiveFPL, livefpl.net calculates this for us. LiveFPL calculates this for us, actually. Livefpl.net, that is. So 41.5% own both DCL and Son at the moment. So in owning both of those highly owned players, you've got a combination that 58.5% of the game don't have. Though, of course, it does work in tiers. So overall, that's what the kind of the figure is. But if you look at just top 10K, then I'd like to be a little bit smaller. But I'm just illustrating this. So I'm going to stick with the overall. Let's add a third in. So you've got DCL, you've got Son, and Kane, who's the third highest owned player at the moment, 44.8% ownership at the time of writing. So Les will say yes to all three being owned than DCL and Son or DCL alone. That's 22.4% of players who own the three highest owned players in the game overall. Obviously, as I said, in the higher echelons, it's probably going to be a bit more. But by having those three owned players, you suddenly have a combination that over three in four managers don't have in the game. And this is why every year you get all these variations in outcomes and why we're all able to be ranked and why each story is always different in fantasy football every single year, because the near infinite combinations in teams compared to other teams, because there are so many different moving parts, is what makes it really fascinating and why compound differential is always really interesting. Because as Oliver's initial question infers, just doubling up and I guess concentrating rather than spreading the risk can create an opportunity. And that was my thinking this game week. It didn't quite work out on having something like Watkins and Grealish, or having something like Ziyech and Chilwell at the back, or indeed having a double defence. Like, they're all absolutely like great examples of how you can have a competitive edge, turn a shield into a sword, and stretched all the way from doing something as kind of mundane as having the double Liverpool defence back in the day, all the way to having a Mala or something like that in midfield. So yeah, I think it's definitely a really valid strategy to look at the high-owned sort of pairings and kind of thinking, yeah, if I pair them together, then suddenly that creates differential and makes a sword of what is perceivably a shield on first glance. Nick, what do you reckon to that?
Yeah, firstly, thanks very much for the lovely comments, Oliver. That's much appreciated. I mean, I might not be perhaps as positive than you were there, Tom, maybe. I don't know. But I feel like when the team is doing excellently, I think there's certainly the case for doubling or tripling up. And obviously, the case for this particular season is Son and Kane. And, you know, it's been excellent, hasn't it? And last season, we spent large swathes of the season tripled up on Liverpool assets. I remember a few game meets, actually, that were absolutely shockers. And I was sitting on about 24 points with triple Liverpool to come. And then you'd finish the game week on 55 or 60 just because of a Salah brace as a captain and, you know, Trent getting some points or Robbo getting some points as well. And, you know, that is brilliant. And it's very, very, very good when you're kind of picking or identifying those teams that are just on fire and in form and that they're worthy of the double or triple up. But as I feel like I still have a few reservations. I think, for instance, some of the examples, you know, with the likes of City, the idea of sort of having Sterling or De Bruyne and Foden to try and cover all angles of the potential attacking returns seems great and is brilliant. Obviously, when you have a firing on all cylinders City, who can score 4 to 5 goals in a game. But I feel like, you know, if you went for this sort of strategy, some people have done this season already, you'd have missed out on so many returns, like some returns or Salah returns or Grealish. And it feels like you're going a little bit against the talisman theory as well to try and focus on those key assets to have, right, you know, from each team, I want Grealish from Aston Villa, Zaha from Palace, Salah from Liverpool, De Bruyne from City or whatever, and Kane from Spurs, etc., etc. And, you know, other examples we've seen this season is those talismans like Calvert-Lewin being so key to Everton getting involved in most of the goals, or Callum Wilson even scoring and getting returns despite Newcastle looking dreadful. So I feel like this is very much, as you said, high risk, high reward. And with the double defences, it can go very, very well. But even last season or the year before, we did see that Liverpool double defence end up being a little bit of a pipe dream that didn't quite materialise for us and often blew up in our faces to a certain extent. So I feel like, especially when you don't have, and this season feels like one of those seasons, reminds me a bit of that season Leicester won the league, when you don't have that team that's really, really standout performer winning week in, week out, going to get 98 points, and I don't think Liverpool or City are going to manage that this season, then, you know, I feel like there's more of a case of diversifying and targeting a few key men and talismans from other teams.
Would you say it's the type of season that allows a parochial side like Tottenham Hotspur to win the league, Nick?
That's a very loaded question and one I'm not necessarily going to answer at this stage. But yeah, I mean, it's been a good start for Spurs. And, you know, that season, that Leicester won the league, Spurs were really in it, so hopefully they can
third in a 2-horse race, famously. Yeah,
well, yeah, hopefully they can mount a challenge, but we'll have to see.
Sorry to the listeners who were listening to that. That was just an attack on Spurs, just for my lols. But I think what you've both done is you've both kind of captured the nub of this issue. Really, is that in general, to try and kind of spread your chances of doing well, following something like talisman theory is a good way of making sure that you do pretty well every week by having the players that score. That's usually penalty takers, and that's usually the top scorer in teams, as we found already earlier in this season and previously. But at the same time, you can obviously profit hugely when a team is playing well and you have multiple players from that team. The skill, of course, is working out which team that will be. And in this season, which, as Nick alluded to, is one of the most unpredictable of all seasons, that's particularly difficult to do. Like, Liverpool are obviously doing quite well this season, and yet I had Mala and it hasn't really gone all that well for me. Whereas the people who had Kane and Son, which was pretty much the alternative choice that I had when I kind of made this decision in like game week 2 or game week 3, have been flying. And so if you can get it right, fantastic. But if you can't get the double up right, it means you double lose. And that's the issue. And so if you can get it right, great. But and so kind of compound, the focusing on the compound differential that kind of comes with just having a good selection of talisman and top players across the league is probably the safer approach. But again, maybe tying back into our look conversation, if you want to win FPL, you probably need to have that home run team selection, whatever that might be. You know, if you had your 2 Spurs players and a few of the other lads who've had particularly high scores so far this season, you'd of course be winning in FPL. But we're not all winning, and that there's a reason why it's not easy. Anyway, I think that brings us to the end of this particular correspondence section. Thanks very much to Ollie for writing in. You'll find Ollie at Ollie Smelt on Twitter. If you want to get to be in the correspondence section in the future, whogottheassist@gmail.com, and we shall have a look and get back to you and include it at a later date. Looking forward to hearing from you all.
Yep. Anthony lives this section, as I've mentioned in past pods. If you want to hear that Hibernian squeal of joy and love from him, definitely do get your questions, queries, pet theories, poems.
Oh, we love poems. We really, really like poems. And send them in as MP3s if you want, and we'll probably just stick it in all together, you know?
We will. We will indeed. Yeah, whogottheassist@gmail.com. Right, moving on to the Q&A. A nice little range of them this week, starting with Harry, FPL Tips, who asked to rank in order these top 5 teams, I suppose. Man City, Man United, Spurs, Liverpool and Chelsea. especially in terms of owning their assets in FPL.
What did you come up with, guys? Nick?
So I guess this is with fixtures not in mind as opposed to the short-term fixtures. So I've actually gone for Liverpool, Spurs, Chelsea, United, City, perhaps a little bit controversial, but just haven't really seen much from the City assets so far this season. And this is this season only. They'll probably go and smash Burnley 4-0, Fulham 4-0, West Brom 4-0 now. But that's what I've just gone for very quickly.
Yeah, that broadly tracks the XG. So I looked at basically XG over the last six game weeks. And yeah, you're basically right. So Liverpool top 15.25, 12 goals, so -3 or something on the XG. That's always good looking. In second, it's Chelsea. In actual second, it's Aston Villa. But in second terms of these five, it's Chelsea. Chelsea, 11.39 XG and 16 goals scored. So not very performance, but Spurs very, very similar. So 11.32, just 0.07 basically off Chelsea in terms of the XG tables. 15 goals scored, 11.32 XG there. In fifth overall, it's Leeds, incredibly, 10.38, 6 goals. And then United, 10.27 and 9. And Man City, 9.72 XG and 5 goals scored. Interestingly, this game week was the first game week that their XG ticked over into underperformance in terms of their overall goals scored. So this game week, over the course of the season, they've now got 13 XG and they've only scored 10. Before this game week, it was an overperformance. They only scored 10 goals, which is just still mental. And I probably would agree with you a little bit there, Nick, but their attacking assets are looking underwhelming. But who knows, maybe fixtures will beget form, as we've said many times on this podcast. And yeah, broad down behind you, Liverpool, Mane, Salah, Jota, maybe two, maybe three if you're mad. Chelsea, you know, the likes of Ziyech, perhaps. Spurs, saw them on my wild card. Man United, there's only Bruno Fernandes, isn't there? And Man City, wait and see is basically how I diagnose that. Anthony, what do you reckon?
Yeah, I think you've kind of tracked this quite well at this point. The problem is with City is that whilst their XG is quite underwhelming and their performances haven't been good, you know that they're kind of just a bomb waiting to go off. And I have De Bruyne in my side right now and I'm kind of struggling to let him. I wouldn't let him go, basically, because I just expect things to go right soon. And even with someone like De Bruyne, if he knocked in his penalty one game week ago, I think the whole entire kind of narrative about him would be very different. So I think, yeah, Liverpool have just clearly shown that they're flying along, but I would rank them behind Spurs. I would go Spurs one from an FPL perspective because you're really looking at Kane and Son. Kane is probably the most informed player in the whole of Europe, maybe with Haaland being the exception on that. Son just continues to return. I just can't be ignored. Yeah, Liverpool 2, Chelsea 3. That's who to pick from Chelsea is kind of more the issue, and that Timo Werner kind of continues to frustrate owners. But this is something that I guess, Tom, you had flagged pre-season and maybe people should have been expecting, but I think he's more frustrating than even he would have expected to be. I'm going to put City in fourth and United in fifth, purely because United won't perform when you expect them to perform. And really, there's one player from United that you're looking at. You're not looking at an alternative option there. To think about Ollie's question there in the correspondence, there is no second option at the moment. Like, as much as I'd love Rashford to be flying or Martial to be doing better, it's just not there. Whereas with City, at least there's the hope. Maybe it's the hope that kills you if you're a City owner. But the fact of the matter is, like, Burnley next, Fulham, then Man United, Derby, craziness, West Brom. Come on, like, you've got to be a bit optimistic about it, and more optimistic than you'd be about the omni-shambles that is Manchester United predictions.
Yeah, Chelsea, just quickly, Ziyech. I mean, you've got a revolving cast of characters everywhere else, but Ziyech plays a unique role because he's the creative force in that team. Yeah, I think he's the prime rib, isn't he, there, really? But anyway, to that City point, there's quite a lot of questions on this week, but the best one probably came from Matthew Jones, at FPL Matthew, you mentioned earlier on. The GOAT, who asked, what do we make of City assets for the upcoming run? And related to this, Claret FPL asked if they could be a red herring, if that's going to be something which is going to be a potential banana skin for managers. So I guess I look at this and I like their defence. In fact, I do like the defence so much. I've got two of them. I've got Cancelo and I've got Diaz. I think the big at the back is going to be coming back. I looked over the course of the next few fixtures, Stag mentioned a second ago, and I just thought that's going to be lots of clean sheets there. In fact, over the next 10, I thought, well, maybe six of them are going to be clean sheets. So I'm looking at, well, yeah, 30 points for one player, 60 points for two players, yeah, 60 points over the course of the next 10, if five of them clean sheets, that's pretty damn good if those players play. Great. In the attack, though, I just can't tell still, basically, between KDB, okay, if he scored a penalty, we'd all be, like, salivating over him, and Sterling as well, a bit of a sleeper asset. With the attack, I think that it's just about who you lose to fit those players in, which is what's really important there. Because in the FPL standpoint, you've got Son and Kane, who a lot of people aren't going to sell. I have sold because I was on my wild card, but if you're not, that's quite difficult to sell now. So both again return against City, and you could be thinking, well, all right, can it get any worse? Probably not. Will you go without Bruno? Well, he's a very damn talismanic, isn't he? In the next two games, you might be thinking, do suit him. Will you go without Mane, Salah and Jota? We've all said now that the Liverpool attack is probably the best. Would you go without a Chelsea attack? Well, we've all again rated the Chelsea attack. Would you go without Vardy? It's a case where it's very, very difficult to beat Ash Ketchum and catch them all. I just don't really see how you're going to be able to do that. So maybe it is the case that, I don't know whether there'll be a red herring. I agree with you, Anthony, that there's no, I find it very, very difficult to see a world where they're not going to be returning a lot. But equally, it may be a case where it's convenient to forge a narrative that they're not particularly enthralling. So why would I own one? I'm quite glad that I'm covering their attack, and maybe I'm going to hope that my existing attackers cover their attack. But it's very difficult as well to see a world where I don't own a City attacker going into Fulham at home. I don't own a City attacker going into West Brom at home. Those look like prime spanking 7 or 8 nil games akin to whenever City play Watford, right? Yeah, it's hard to tell at the moment. I'm willing to give them Burnley at least to see what's going on. And I'm actually quite looking at Sterling because the ownership is so low and everyone's flocking to KDB. So it'd be very interesting to go another way. Anthony, what do you reckon there?
See, this is the thing. And I've been kind of mulling this over as well. And I'll probably be making a premium transfer this week. And, De Bruyne could have been the one who was on the chopping block. He obviously won't be coming with Burnley coming up next. But with him versus Bruno Fernandes, it basically boils down to who do you think is going to get more penalties in the next few weeks, and then who is going to be around their opposition box more. And I do think this is going to, we're moving off into the upper echelons of the luck discussion, but I think United have been lucky to get as many penalties as they have so far this year. Over the course of this season, they're definitely kind of getting their penalties in early, and I think they'll revert to the mean, to use that phrase again, a little bit more, whereas I think just City should pick up a few more. And so with that in mind, having a penalty taker from City would be beneficial. As well as that, I do think that whilst United and Bruno are good, City can really explode to a much higher degree than Manchester United. And that's another reason why I personally want to keep De Bruyne in my side and have him as that talisman ready for the day that everything goes right for him. Of course, I'll have missed out on how many points in the meantime? A huge amount. And you could obviously throw that back in my face all the time. Tom, likewise, I brought in Cancelo this week, probably a week too early, but I just felt like doing the transfer. It was just one of those things. I kind of fancied them against Spurs for some reason. So I brought him in, and yeah, it's just over the course of the next few weeks, if he holds his place, which of course is the forever Pep caveat that you have to add, he should pick up quite a few clean sheets. I think they're a much more solid defensive unit than they have been. And so really it's just a matter of hoping for that attack to grind into gear soon, because it's been quite disappointing so far.
Yeah, I think for me, I think there's only one City attacking asset that I'm keen on, and that's Kevin De Bruyne. And I have actually been quite strongly considering bringing him into my team just because of obviously the fixtures. But in terms of the underlying stats, he's just yards above any other City player if you want attacking returns this season. It's worth highlighting, he only actually played 472 minutes, but still he's had sort of 19 goal attempts, which is sort of a chance every 24.8 minutes in terms of sort of like the players that have played more than five games. That ranks second only to Mo Salah in terms of the midfielders, who's had a chance every 21.1 minutes. So De Bruyne is seemingly creating a lot of chances for himself, getting forward a lot. He's obviously creating a lot of chances as well, as he always does. We know how brilliant he was creating chances, getting assists out of nowhere, creating, you know, always finding that ball. He's an absolute master at that. And he's been a little bit unfortunate only really to have the one goal and three assists, considering those underlying stats. So he's definitely a sleeping giant in terms of a massive haul coming his way. So yeah, for him, it's 20 chances created, which is one less than Salah, the same as Bruno. But as I said, he has played less minutes. So, you know, better ratio in terms of chances created per minute of 24. And yeah, in terms of the other City assets, it's twice as many as any other City midfielder. None of them are on the same level as him in terms of creating those chances. So he's going to play every minute. What I was going to say is, what we don't know about Sterling, he didn't play this week. He's a bit out of favour. Pep seems to be sort of favouring Torres a little bit more. Morris, thought he might be in the wilderness, but doesn't seem to be. He started as well. Foden's desperate for minutes. So there's plenty of rotation there in terms of the City attacking assets. For the defenders, Tom, obviously, big fan of them, obviously, with the double defence there. But, you know, probably going to be some clean sheets. The attacking returns are pretty dreadful. No one has showed any goal threat at all, apart from Walker having a few pot shots. But João Cancelo, he'll be the one I'd look at if you want to try and find an attacking return as well, because he's third for all defenders with 11 chances created. So maybe at 5.5 million, he'd be the other one I'd consider in terms of a real FPO asset.
Yeah, just the one name we didn't mention through all that discussion was Sergio Aguero, and you could just cite him as an upside for Kevin De Bruyne, or you could cite him as an independent upside in and of himself, and you would expect that he will get more game time in the coming weeks. He's no longer flagged. He was available for selection, but just didn't play at the weekend. And so you would expect that when he gets time, that City's finishing will improve. And one thing as well, maybe to point about City, in a way, they've kind of almost accelerated their arc towards a Barcelona tribute act, in that they've reached the decay phase in one sense.
Yeah.
Would you not say that the way they, when they're struggling, look to De Bruyne is very like how Barcelona, when they're struggling, now look to Messi?
Just give it to Messi. Give
yeah,
it to
and
De
it's just yeah, give it to Kev, and just Kev surges through. It's a very obviously different type of play, but the way he's relied on to literally
do
make
stuff.
Every chance,
yeah.
Create everything, just, you know, grab the ball by the, or grab the game by the cojones and just actually just take a shot. Like, and he's doing much more wild shots than he used to, in my memory as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. But I think also as well, the start of every season, and, you know, I said this a couple of weeks back, we've documented the fact that the 10 goals they've scored is just unthinkable compared to the last few years. But also, over the last few years, there's been one man who's been fit. That's Sergio Aguero, as you've mentioned. All right, he's a bit older now. Okay, yeah, we'll accept that. He's from my age, so he's over the hill, forgotten, unfit, fat.
Not making memes yet, is he?
He's not making memes yet on FPL Twitter, but he will be able to make an Alex McCarthy eight-arm meme fairly soon. But nonetheless, you know, I think it'd be really interesting to see, because I think that having Jesus to some extent, or Aguero, like having that forward option active for City is really, really interesting, because you've got another avenue to go in. Because as I mentioned, a lot of the players that I did mention here were all midfielders, you know, Bruno, Son, Mane, Salah, Chelsea attackers. If you're not going to buy Werner because you've got someone like Vardy, you've got Kane stuck in there, like, a lot of the time, the space for a City player, I guess, in the current kind of template is going to be in the attack, in the striker position. So if you can get a Jesus in, if you can get a Aguero in, then that would be absolutely fantastic. It's definitely something that I'd be, you know, looking at and hoping it will come out from the Burnley game.
I think certainly as well, they're also missing out on the David Silva factor, who's been such a huge factor for them over the past 10 or so seasons. And he's joined Real Sociedad, who are now top of La Liga. So clearly having an impact there, and City are clearly missing him a little bit as well.
Yeah, and so are we, because we can't say Dilver, but we can say Tilver. So there you go.
And we can't say Bilva because of his almost near enforced absence as well.
Sad.
What's going on with our lives? Anyway, let's move on. And the next one is sticking with Spurs. So your countryman, Paddy, FPL King, Anthony, says that there are many, such as wildcarders, who have binned off the likes of Son and Kane with the international break for other options and were often not rewarded this week. Where do we now stand on Spurs? So quite painful for me, but I think that if I did have both of them, I would be probably more tempted, actually, given the upcoming fixtures, hold on to Son. Actually, I think there's a lot of games which are going to favour the counter attack for Spurs coming up. And Kane's actually an absolute monster this season. It was actually really scary not owning him. But Chelsea, Arsenal, Crystal Palace, Liverpool, and to some extent Leicester, they're all going to be games which are going to favour the likes of Son scoring on the counter attack. And I think that he'd be the one who I'd just be holding and hoping for a Salah season if I could. I had to go for a punt on the wild card, but at the same time, I think that if I wasn't on the wild card, I'd probably be having a very, very tough decision making process to see which one I was going to be getting rid of. What do you guys reckon here? I think that Nick, you got both of them. Anthony, you got one. So it'd be interesting to see.
I've still got both. I mean, talking about luck earlier, my planned transfer was Son to Bruno, so that Salah getting COVID meant I kept Son and got his 10 points, so in that respect it's a little bit lucky, but I still kind of want to disinvest and get rid of one of them. It's just too many players that I want to bring in, to be honest. I don't have Vardy, I don't have De Bruyne, I don't want Salah, and I want one or if not two of them this game week somehow. So yeah, I think one's going to leave. It's probably going to be Son. I know that Kane loves a London derby. I did have a quick look to see how he's got on against Chelsea before. In sort of 13 games, he's got 6 goals to assist. So, you know, not amazing, but not too shabby either. So definitely a chance of return. You know, I was happy with the returns, obviously, in that last game against City. But, you know, the Spurs fixtures are still pretty tough. Chelsea and Arsenal, I mean, you know, and Liverpool as well, and Leicester in the next 5. So I think certainly with the other assets, there are other players I'd want to bring in for them, even though they'd be brilliant this season.
So when it comes to Spurs, I think that they are definitely a side making a title tilt, and they shouldn't be dismissed because of their, you know, the history of the Tottenham, as Giorgio Chiellini once said. Like they clearly have much more about them at the moment in a season where a lot of teams are struggling. And I think these upcoming 2 games, Chelsea away, Arsenal at home, are monumental ones for their season. So I'd expect them to try and ground out a result. Not necessarily on the counter-attack per se, because I think it'll be kind of 50-50 possession type games in both of them. But it's just Kane is the one that I would want to keep out of Kane and Son. And I am a Kane owner, so whoever wants to point at vested interests and all that, da, 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 you can get on your high horse if you want. But I just think Kane, as a player who has just been performing so well this season, I think I've said it earlier in the pod, across Europe, I think there are very few players who are performing better than him. I do think Son has probably benefited from fortune a little bit. And I think Son does particularly well when Spurs are really piling it on. Whereas I think Kane is kind of the guy who will come in with the clutch goals, to use an American phrase, that little bit more. Yeah. So that's why I would like to hold him. But where do we stand on Spurs overall? I don't think we should be standing. I think we should be kneeling and genuflecting. Like, that's how good they are from an FPL perspective by comparison to most of the other teams this season.
Yeah, a lot of consistency there, I think. Rush to the fixtures that I had to, but I think if I was wildcarding from a position of strength rather than a position of catching up, I probably would have kept at least one, if not both, Spurs assets. Right, and linked to that, judging wildcard success. So General Zod asks, mainly me, how do we judge wildcard success? Right away, it's all been terrible. I'm deleting my account and stopping who got the assist is the answer to that. It's terrible. Goodbye, people. No, rationally, I think the answer is probably about 3 to 4 weeks worth of outcomes. I think that's always quite nice. I think you guys wildcard in game week 5, didn't you? So you had kind of that nice little block between game week 5, game week 4 to 5 was the first game week you guys had your wildcard, and you had a nice little block between game week 5 and game week 8, those 4 weeks to assess how well your wildcard had done. There's that well-worn adage, which is, I've got to remind myself, I wildcarded for the long term, not just one game week. So I think I'm going to be doing that again this week. My bus team looks amazing. next few weeks. I'm sure my bus team's going to look pretty damn good. And I'm just hoping that my gamble sort of pays off. I will remember the fact that I've had one game week, which has been really, really bad. But over the course of the next sort of 7 or 8 weeks, hopefully it will pick up and I'll make up those unique points that I need to make in order to get a respectable rank. So hopefully by the time I'm speaking again on this in December time, it's going to be all hunky-dory. So, guys, you both wildcarded fairly recently, well, in the last kind of 5 weeks or so. How do you assess the success of your wildcards? Nick, how's it gone for you? Bloody amazing, mate.
Yeah. I mean, I said before that it's not just about the first week. You have to kind of, I think Mitchell asked us a question, didn't he, as part of the correspondence section. And yeah, it's kind of over like a 4 to 5 game week period. And that's your assessment. And obviously, yeah, I'm happy with how things have gone. Sort of 4 green arrows out of 5 is pretty decent since I wildcarded. Everything looks pretty hunky-dory. Most of the decisions I made, I mean, and I'll try not to sound like I'm tooting my horn too much, but yeah, most decisions I made have worked out in my favour. It was a particularly pinnacle moment getting in Son and Kane, for instance, who I didn't have before that, which kind of almost pushed me towards that wildcard button. Now I'm in a situation where I'm looking enviously actually at your team, Tom. So I'm looking at some of the assets you've got now. You've got the Mane coverage and the Vardy coverage, you know, and I don't have these players for these plum fixtures. I'm still stuck with the Spurs guys. So you know, you have to kind of look ahead. It's not about 1 week. It's a 4 to 5 game week period. And trying to, you know, doing the wild card for me in game week 5 was a critical moment because it has allowed me to propel up the ranks.
You see, realistically, looking at my team, it wasn't a poor selection. And I don't even, with hindsight, I don't look back on the side itself and go like, ugh, it's a bad team. Why did I do that? But the fact of the matter is that, you know, I started around 2 million in rank. Now I'm at 1.5 million in rank 5 weeks later. So that wouldn't necessarily suggest that I've had serious fortune. But really what I would point to as the only decision that I regret is I doubled up on Liverpool and avoided the likes of Bruno Fernandes, avoided having the Spurs double up. I, at that stage, still wasn't sure if Spurs could kind of continue to do as well as they had. They'd collapsed. They'd trashed United and they'd trashed Southampton, but they'd still had those two bad results against Everton and Newcastle that kind of tinged me with doubts where I kind of had more belief in Liverpool. And so it just hasn't quite worked out in that sense. But really, if you swap Mane to Son, even the difference of 30, 40 points would probably be enough to put me in a position where I'd be very happy with this wildcard. And so it's like, I could overfocus on just the rank, but really there's just one decision within the greater team that really has made the difference. And that's, you know, that's the fall of the ball, I guess. And I'm okay with that. I think overall, I'm still quite well set. I haven't had to take any hits since, for example. Like, I haven't gone burning the team that I had. So look, overall, we're okay, guys. 1.2 million. We'll survive.
Fine margins, eh? All right, okay. And the final question this week came from Dino, FPL Dare, Newcastle resident, who says he's got Jimenez still. Got an assist tonight, actually. Very lucky one. Hit the post. And he asks, should he be making him into Dominic Calvert-Lewin now? He's worried that he's missed the boat and is at times just kind of, you know, cut the cord and look elsewhere. So okay, maybe it's a question not so much about Jimenez, Dominic Calvert-Lewin, but maybe a bit more about missing the boat in FPL, guys. I mean, what do you guys think about this whole sort of notion? And for me, it may feel very boring buying these players, but it's never boring scoring points simply. So often it's the case that you're kind of thinking, oh, you know, it's bad. I mean, Anthony, you bought Dominic Calvert-Lewin on your wild card. I bought Dominic Calvert-Lewin on my wild card. And neither of us complaining about the decision compared to buying Richarlison. So it's almost the case that you kind of sometimes have to suck it up and just go for it, don't you? A really quote-unquote boring transfer, an obvious transfer, because at the end of the day, it's always great to be picking up those hygiene points everyone else gets and letting other people make the mistake. What do you reckon?
Yeah, like it's easy to overcomplicate these decisions sometimes, but like it's never a bad decision or a boring decision to bring in the top scoring player in the league who's less than 8 million into your team. Like, just as simple as that. With someone like DCL, in terms of missing the boat generally, I think, yeah, Tom, you've kind of hit the nail on the head. It's, you know, don't think about the decisions that you previously made that you're trying to hold on to and vindicate in the longer term. I think it's just you've got to look forward, look at the fixtures, look at the players that you have, and if you think that someone you don't have is going to do better and you can get them in without taking hits and screwing your whole entire team over, you should probably get them in.
Yeah, exactly. I think we've looked at some of our decisions in the past, just kind of completely missing out on sort of the Ings wagon from last year, or myself with the Vardy wagon when Leicester won the league, and regret it all ultimately. So I think there's no shame in recognising where you've got this sort of sunk cost fallacy, I guess, and righting a wrong perhaps in terms of some of your earlier decision making.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. And I think we're pretty much moving towards wrapping up the pod. But before we do that, we'll have to look at our transfers and captains for the coming week. Nicholas, what are you planning?
So I feel like I've got some really critical decisions to make this week. Feels like very important. So I've got ideas, but I haven't got anything set in stone. I think Zaha also potentially being out has put a little bit of spanner into the plans as well. So I could potentially even look at swapping him out for Jota or something and you know, getting him in as perhaps some sort of like Salah coverage. I don't know. But no, that's one idea. I could potentially downgrade Robertson, get in De Bruyne or Salah as well, or maybe even doing Vardy in for Kane. So got a few disparate plans going through my head currently, nothing set in stone. And ironically, actually, in terms of the captains, whoever I bring in will probably be the captain as well, whether it's Salah, if I bring him in, whether it's De Bruyne, whether it's Vardy, whoever comes in will probably end up with the armband because I at the moment I've got it still on Fernandez, Southampton away, but I think whoever comes in probably has a better fixture than that.
Yeah, no, it certainly makes sense. I'm going to leave it for another week. I've got 0.2 million, so I can do the Mane to Salah switch straight away if I wanted to, if he's looking like he'll be back for Brighton. I'm kind of half tempted, actually. I know that sounds a bit stupid, but I'm very tempted because it is a transfer I'm probably going to make at some point, so why not make it now is my thinking. Probably would be more effective our 2-3 transfers so I could deal the man, so I can address the Man City situation. And you know, if Jota keeps going, maybe I'd have Jota as being the cover, and 6.6 million now, I'd be able to kind of say, right, okay, he's a cheap sort of Liverpool representation, so then I can get a Sterling or a KDB in. But you know, I'm tempted, but I probably will leave it and probably captain Vardy and just be done with that, I think. What about you, Anthony?
Yeah, for those of you who make those teams week by week to try and get the top scorer, I would love to have Jamie Vardy on my side, but I'm not sure if I can do it from my own like structural perspective. I've Kane and DCL and they're not leaving my side anytime soon, but upgrading Brewster to Kane would take some sort of budgetary war crime, so I'm not quite sure I'm going to manage that. I was actually looking at the side grade as well, Tom, that you were looking at of Mane to Salah. It was actually something that I was considering doing once I sold Salah for missing this game week. I kind of thought, right, well, Mane has a week to prove himself or he just becomes Salah and he just becomes my sole Liverpool representative in my side until I get the likes of Jota or Robertson or TAA when he's back into the team. So that side grade, I think, is the most likely option. In terms of the captaincy, it could actually be Kevin De Bruyne for the captaincy. He'd be in the lead so far, but I could quite easily change that decision as the week goes on.
Cool. So we were Who Got The Assist. Thanks so much, guys, for listening, and make sure to hit that subscribe button if you haven't already.
Cheers, folks. It was good to be back this week and great to be back after a whole month away, which is a pretty daft amount of time for me to have missed out on. But if you want to get your correspondence in, whogottheassist@gmail.com to, as Tom says, make me squeal.
That sounds really disgusting.
Oh, yeah, it does.
In general, we hope this is to think about the impact of luck and fine margins in FBL. And as Anthony mentioned, we will speak to you next week and you can make me squeal next week. Goodbye.
Whogottheassist@gmail.com. Oh dear.
You
just another week on the internet, eh?
Oh, it's a goal. Who got the assist? Who got the assist?
Sports Social Podcast Network.